We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined on the morning after the primaries on Tuesday, this Wednesday, by my colleague Tristan Justice, Western correspondent at the Federalist. Tristan, thank you so much for stopping by.
Well, thank you for having me.
Of course. We like talking with you about campaigns and elections because you follow them so closely. And the actually one of the most high profile candidates on the ballot yesterday is somebody that you talked to over the course of your reporting. And that would be Kathy Barnett, who emerged as a very interesting figure in the Pennsylvania primary last night. Tristan, it's really no surprise that she came in third place. She put up impressive numbers. So far, we're seeing about 25% to the split 31-31% between Dr. Oz and David McCormick. That race, Tristan, I'll have some questions for you about how it's shaking out. Looks like it's headed for a recount. No real surprise that Barnett is in third, although I think putting up 25%. In that late game surge was really interesting from her. Now, what are you reading into this race? A lot of before we start talking about primaries, I always think it's important to say the national media looks at primaries as an opportunity to further very facile narratives, to sort of squeeze local competitions into a national box that they don't always fit into. So with that being said, Tristan, what is your takeaway from the Pennsylvania race where it stands right now?
Well, I think the Pennsylvania race is actually probably one of the most interesting primaries this year, if not the most interesting primary of the year. You have Kathy Barnett, who is really kind of had that late stage surge, as you mentioned, who looked like she was going to pull off an upset. I mean, she even got big money from major groups in the last week of the campaign. The Club for Growth, which had supported Josh Mandel in Ohio, put in $2 million, according to the New York Times, supporting Barnett in those final days leading up to yesterday's contest. I think the race really highlights the dangers of what happens when you have a two-man contest throughout most of the race, because as voters, I think, began to kind of, there was so much negative campaigning going on between Dr. Oz and then Dave McCormick that I think voters may have began to look for another option. They saw Kathy Barnett. She had an amazing debate. She scored huge points. And they looked to her as a viable alternative, as this person who is really just a political commentator before jumping into the Senate race. Beforehand, she had only lost one. She really won for office one time, and that was for a House district around Philadelphia. And she lost that race pretty handily. And so when you have a two-person contest until the last week and a half of the campaign, that's how a kind of a third person who has a stellar debate performance can rise up and potentially pull off an upset. Now, that lane just wasn't big enough for her at the end. The race hasn't been called yet, but it's pretty clear that she's in a distant third with not even 25% of the vote, whereas Dr. Oz and McCormick are each tied at 31%. Oz is up a little bit by about 1,500 votes. But Kathy Barnett's an interesting race. She, when you have a good debate and you have late money coming in, she almost did it, but it just wasn't enough to carry away the win.
Yeah, there's a lot to work with there. Tristan, why don't you tell us first, though, since you have interviewed Kathy Barnett, what your impressions of her were after, you know, having conversations?
She impressed me, actually. I did a little bit of reporting on the Pennsylvania race, albeit from Denver, Colorado. But I did some report. I think the first story I did on the Pennsylvania race was the Pittsburgh Gazette sent out a candidate survey to all the Republicans in the race, asking them a series of questions. And one of the questions on the extended answer or on a multiple choice was about whether the 2020 election was legitimate, whether Joe Biden won fairly. And of course, it's a gotcha question, considering all the different issues that when it happened during the 2020 election. And so I spoke to all the candidates, or at least reached out to all the candidates. And Kathy was the only candidate to personally call me back for that story. And she was articulate. She knew exactly what she wanted to say and how she wanted to say it. And she was the only one who impressed me on that story. So I talked with her again. I did kind of a mini profile of her as she began to surge. And again, she was articulate. She knew what points she wanted to get across and you know, what her message was. But at the end of the day, this is someone who hadn't really been the target of much scrutiny up until this last home stretch of the campaign. Again, when it becomes a two-man race, all the other candidates fall into the background and they don't get targeted with the kind of opposition research that Dave McCormick and Dr. Oz get. And so as soon as she became as soon as she became statistically tied for first place in all these major polls at the end, she became the target of some serious opposition research. And I think that really handicapped her rise to the point where it just wasn't enough to get her over the top. It's kind of similar to what happened with Michael Bloomberg. He had this surge going into that Democratic primary, but as soon as he got into the debate stage and became the target of everybody else's attacks on stage, his campaign just cratered. And so my concern about Kathy was, you know, even though she's articulate, even though she's a good conservative voice, she might be better as a conservative media personality than she would be a senator. This is someone with really no public policy experience. She was in the Army Reserves for 10 years, which is great and illustrates a dedication to service. But again, she hadn't really been subjected to serious vetting that candidates usually get throughout competitive primaries. And she hadn't been the target of other attacks from other candidates. And those were, I think, the two biggest vulnerabilities that ultimately kept her from taking the win.
So Tristan, I there's a lot to, I think, break down, especially even in, I guess, interpreting the media coverage and all that. But before we get there, it looks like this race is headed for a recount. This is, again, the Senate race. It looks like because of the razor thin margin that separates Dr. Oz and David McCormick is, I think, probably going to be within 2,500. I think that's the recall threshold that we're going to, or the recount threshold that we're headed for a recount here. Mail-in ballots are still outstanding. There are certain counties as we speak that are still counting votes. And with that razor thin margin, it's just impossible to say who's going to win right now. What do you expect to see, Tristan? Where is this headed?
Oh boy, I don't know where it might be headed. We're definitely going to have a recount. I'm looking at these numbers, of course, refreshing it like everybody else is across Washington. It's going to be a close recount, and is Oz going to pull? Oz going to pull it out? I'm not sure. It's just going to be contingent. I think the fact that there's a lot of mail-in ballots outstanding, I think that's probably going to go to McCormick's favor. Just the fact that it was a two-way contest leading up to the last final day. So I think people were probably voting for McCormick before potentially switching their votes. I think there's a lot of skepticism of Dr. Oz, kind of similar to the skepticism that was lobbied against Donald Trump in 2016. How conservative is he actually? He's made prior statements in support of abortion. Is he actually going to be pro-life once he's elected? He says he's going to be, but he endorsed abortion in some pretty strong terms in the past. He's endorsed transgender ideology. So how conservative is this guy who's claiming to be a champion of the Trump agenda? How conservative is he actually going to be in office? And so I think those are questions that scared a lot of people off from Dr. Oz and may play to McCormick's favor.
Yes. This is, sorry, Tristan, I was getting an echo from you, so I muted you. but there's a lot to unpack in terms of media coverage where they were spinning this race as a sort of neat Trump narrative. And actually, there was another race in Pennsylvania, the gubernatorial primary, Tristan, that you can tell us about as well, that was also being fit into that box, or they were seeking to fit it into that box. And interestingly enough, I don't know that that's actually what happened here. The Trump endorsement, the media wanted to see this, and some people in the political class wanted to see a lot of these races as a referendum on the power of Donald Trump's endorsement. I think the results every time we have that conversation are simply that the power of Donald Trump's endorsement depends on the local issues at hand in any given race. But Tristan, in terms of Donald Trump, who had endorsed Dr. Oz, a lot of the, I guess maybe I would say like the MAGA base was really interested in McCormick, or I'm sorry, was really interested in Barnett late in the game, because I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction with how conservative Dr. Oz is, his connections to China, his early support for trans ideology on TV, whether he actually is carpetbagging. Actually, that's an issue that faced a lot of the candidates. but the power of the Trump endorsement, did we get any more information on that at all last night?
In terms of the Trump endorsement, the results are really mixed, but I think what gets lost in the commentary on the Trump endorsement is localized politics and the idea that it's not necessarily about Trump's blessing anymore. It's about how much candidates embrace Trumpism now. And so, I mean, you saw, and I think we need to also start looking at these races a little more isolated than in an overall picture. And I think Madison Cawthorn's race is a perfect example of that. You have a 26-year-old freshman congressman, who's the youngest person ever, I'm pretty sure youngest person ever elected to Congress. He's going to be a one-term congressman now after a successful primary challenge ousted him last night. But this is, I mean, of course, Cawthorn had the Trump endorsement in the closing hours of the race, but it wasn't enough to keep him over the line. But Cawthorn made a showman of himself in Congress. He just wasn't a serious legislator. He wasn't a serious statesman. He was obsessed with the image, the media hits, the profile. So I think that's one area where people are going to try to say, well, Trump's endorsement isn't the end all be all. But again, we need to start looking at these races a little more localized and isolated with the different nuances that the smaller races deserve. And so going back to Pennsylvania, Mastriano, he was very effective in embracing the Trump brand, embracing Trumpism and this kind of brand of conservative populism that the Republican Party has really taken to now. And I think one thing interesting that came out of the PA race is also Mastriano and Kathy Barnett kind of ran on a similar ticket. They were at each other's campaign events. They endorsed each other and were supporting each other across the state. And it's interesting, Mastriano did not have a close race last night. He won by 24 points with 44% of the vote compared to Lou Barletta at 20%. So Mastriano did not have a close race and Barnett had a lot closer of a contest.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these My Pillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at My Pillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those roll and go anywhere MyPillows. You can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/Federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist. It's odd to me that the Pennsylvania Senate primary, and I think this explains a little bit of the Barnett surge, came down to Dr. Oz and David McCormick, a very wealthy businessman married to Dina Powell. Somebody like we're talking about it, these two men really trying to run, I mean this seriously, almost in a populist vein And they were, it was a nasty primary. It was not unlike what we saw in Ohio. In fact, of course, some of the same consultants were behind the scenes in Ohio and in Pennsylvania. It was bitter and nasty. But you can understand why, for the average Republican voter, a lot of people may have shifted to Barnett after her very strong debate performance, where she was she spoke pretty movingly and was very, I think, well spoken. And you just look at these two options, they're so underwhelming. And it just does seem interesting to me, Tristan, that in this primary, which we should say, there is so much on the line in Pennsylvania. We have a 50-50 split in the Senate right now. It's very, very close. These swing state races for control of the Senate are just crucial. They're so key. There's going to be a lot of money poured into them between now and November. So who Republicans nominated was really important. And that's why Donald Trump came and said, Oz is the electable one. He's the guy who can win the general. Kathy Barnett cannot do that. The establishment Republicans are terrified of Mastriano. They don't think he can win the general for the governor's race. But it's so interesting to me that in this competition where the media is trying to test the strength of MAGA, these men are they're so underwhelming in terms of like whether they're, I guess, legitimately whether they have legitimately the best interests of the Republican voter, the working class, even at heart.
I think that's correct, and I have a little bit of optimism that Dr. Oz could surprise all of us. I think Dr. Oz has potential to have that Trump trajectory where you run for office as a first-time candidate on the Republican side, and there's a lot of skepticism about your own conservatism after you've endorsed abortion, after you've endorsed some of these more radical ideologies from the left, and then you run on a Republican platform, a conservative platform, and you get into office and then end up being a conservative lawmaker. And I think Trump was largely motivated. I think he was flexible in all these issues because Trump wanted to be president so bad. He wanted all of the glitzy things that come with being president. And I think he was attracted to the attention, the notoriety, and everything that comes with being a politician. I kind of have to wonder if Dr. Oz is similar in that he's not afraid to be flexible on some of these more defining issues for the sake of being a prominent politician. And I don't mean to question Oz's sincerity about being, being in service, but I struggle to understand the motives of a very rich celebrity wanting to quit their daytime television job and jump into a reputation-destroying, politicized campaign, polarizing campaign, and be a politician. So I kind of wonder if that celebrity mentality, which I don't think anyone can really truly understand unless they were a celebrity, I wonder if that same celebrity mentality is carried with Dr. Oz as it was with Trump when he first ran in 2016.
I think it's, I don't have the same sort of reflexive, I guess I'm just suspicious of anybody who wants to get into politics, period, because, it's more likely that they're interested in power than genuinely doing something good. And you can, there are completely exceptions to that rule, but I think the rule stands based on what we see when people immediately get into Congress or into the power in the first place. So Tristan, we've spent a lot of time on Pennsylvania precisely for the reason that we just mentioned, which is that this Senate race is a swing state, and it is going to really have have consequences for who controls the Senate and what the makeup of the Senate looks like going forward. There were some other races as well. You mentioned Madison Cawthorn. I think Madison Cawthorn has been an embarrassment. I have a lot of sympathy for Madison Cawthorn. Actually, when Donald Trump endorsed him, he, in a very Trumpian fashion, made actually a pretty decent point that Madison Cawthorn's been through a lot of trauma. I think Trump said something like he lost the bottom half of his body in the second, basically, and rose to fame really quickly, and is a, it just seems like his life is not in a good place. But like I said, I really think he's been an embarrassment. Now, the establishment went all out to try to stop Madison Cawthorn. And this was, again, because Trump endorsed Madison Cawthorn, seen as a referendum on the power of the Trump endorsement. Tristan, you've already made an important point that these are these races, you know, there might be a little bit of both at play, but it's really about what's happening on the state level, especially in primaries, where you have, you know, generally the base turning out to cast a ballot. I know you were following races in Idaho. There, especially for the left, was a race in Oregon that we should talk about. What else were you paying, other than Cawthorn and PA, both Mastriano and the Senate? What else were you paying close attention to last night that you think people should know about?
Well, I was actually watching some of the races on the Democratic side, because I think there is an interesting shift within the Democratic Party, kind of maybe realizing how far left they've really gone, and how they might need to pick some more relatively centrist candidates in an election year that is going to be incredibly hostile. We know in the first midterms of any new president, it's historically hostile to the president's party in power. And so this is not shaping up to be a friendly cycle to Democrats, especially as Americans are antagonized by 40-year inflation and record high gas prices that we've never seen before. So there's this interesting shift, I think, potentially happening in the Democratic Party, looking at some of these House primaries that they had. So the exception of that is in Oregon, but I'll touch on Kentucky and North Carolina first, where the kind of centrist branded candidates in the North Carolina's first congressional district and Kentucky's third congressional district, those moderate branded candidates actually carried the primary over progressive challengers who are endorsed by the typical endorsements that come from Justice Democrats. It's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders, and some of those personalities. And I think that follows a trend that we kind of began to see in Ohio, in that Cleveland district between Chantel Brown and Nina Turner. Nina Turner was backed by all the progressive big names, and the incumbent who carried the special election last fall, Chantel Brown, she carried the primary for a second time against Turner. So I'm sensing this kind of shift as to where the Democratic Party wants to go. And the party itself has just gone so far left. So even a centrist candidate is still someone who endorsed the Green New Deal, which is an explicitly socialist program. But the one exception to that, of course, looking at these in a local context, is Oregon, where the incumbent, Kurt Schrader, actually lost to a progressive challenger. But let's keep in mind, this was a Portland area district. So this is essentially Antifa land. They're going to vote as far left as they can get a candidate to go. So I think there's an interesting shift that may be happening on the Democratic Party. It'll be interesting to see some of these future House races and these primaries as the year moves forward. But I also followed some other Republican races, namely in Idaho. We had a primary against Governor Brad Little, and this was actually a fascinating race, a Trump-endorsed challenger against Trump's only endorsed two, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I can only count two incumbent governors that Donald Trump has endorsed primary challengers to. That's in Georgia, where Trump endorsed former Senator David Perdue against Brian Kemp, and Idaho, where Trump endorsed the lieutenant governor against Brad Little. And that race was interesting because the lieutenant governor up there, she, while Brad Little was out of the state, she would use the powers that she had, taking over authority as governor while the current governor was gone, and she would actually sign executive orders reversing what Governor Little had done. And so it was a fascinating dynamic to play out. So Brad Little actually was essentially trapped in his own state. I remember going through a Republican Governors Association conference in November, and Governor Little wasn't there because he couldn't leave the state because he didn't want the lieutenant governor to be reversing everything he'd done. He won the race pretty handily, but there was also a Secretary of State race in Idaho between three candidates, two of which were named controversial by the legacy press for claiming that Joe Biden had not won the 2020 election fairly. And the one who did say it was a fair election actually carried the race in the end by about 5,000 votes.
So let's shift to the left, because Tristan, you just brought up a number of really interesting races. And actually, there was a funny parallel between Mastriano and what happened to Nina Turner, as you mentioned, versus Chantel Brown in that Ohio race. And Tristan is an Ohio native, so he may have more to say on that. And also, this is kind of funny. I'm reading a paragraph I'm reading the lead and my friend Ryan Grimm's story for The Intercept. A Republican-backed super PAC on Tuesday fell short in its bid to intervene in a Democratic primary against Pennsylvania State Rep. Summer Lee, a 34-year-old Black woman and rising star in the party who fended off a tsunami of outside money to best anti-union attorney Steve Irwin. The spending from a GOP-backed super PAC linked to APAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, left Irwin behind by less than 1,000 votes. Now, Nina Turner had a similar sort of deluge of money. People thought that she was anti-Israel, and a lot of money, even from Republicans, was going into this Democratic primary to boost Chantel Brown, or perceived Republicans, I suppose you could say, ostensible Republicans. And then also in Mastriano's race, this is really interesting, Democrats spent to boost Mastriano because they thought he was the easier candidate to beat. So it's not just happening in one direction. It was also happening with Mastriano. And so what we have right now, and this is always true, the base is always going to be, I guess it depends on how you define base, but is always going to be pushing probably in a more ideological direction than centrist. And that's certainly happening in both cases now. But Tristan, to your point, the center of the Democratic Party, you have Republicans terrified of Mastriano. You have, I think, establishment Democrats less afraid of the squad type folks than they used to be, but still, you know, a little afraid of them, to the point where a lot of money was spent to help Schrader in Oregon, who doesn't seem like he's going to hang on to his seat. This is a guy who was very proudly moderate. In fact, he was, you know, actively sort of pushing the singing the praises of moderation in Congress. That's sort of a mission of his. It looks like he's going down to a progressive, someone who sort of reminds me a little bit of Fetterman in Pennsylvania. What was your read on how the we don't want to do what the left does and the media does to the right and try to squeeze local races into the national box? But Tristan, what was your read on what happened in the Democratic Party? Ryan's headline, I should say before I throw it to you, Tristan, is Democratic voters deliver stinging rebuke to party's mansion cinema wing. Do you agree with that takeaway from what you've seen so far?
No, I don't, considering the fact that the more moderate branded candidates carried the day in North Carolina, Kentucky. And again, I think Oregon is an exception. I was in Portland last summer, and it's not a conservative bastion of America up there, Emily. So I don't think necessarily think that's accurate. I think the reality is the Democrats are facing down at the barrel of an election cycle that is going to be, I'll steal a phrase from, I think it was Monica Crowley on Fox last night, an extinction level event. Americans are so fed up by what's happened over the last just year and a half, the enthusiastic forfeiture of energy independence, the apathy when it comes to inflation, that all of a sudden has become a top White House priority. All these different things that Americans are feeling every day in their wallets, it's antagonizing to the point where they're gonna vote Republican. And it doesn't just stop at the wallet. People are fed up with some of the cultural shifts and changes that have been going on over the last 2 years. Elon Musk, a guy who started an electric car company, announced today that he's actually going to vote Republican based on the cultural shift where the Democratic Party has gone. So I have to wonder if you know, maybe we're seeing some sort of reckoning, at least among some portion of the Democratic Party, as to where it's actually going. But I think time's going to have to tell on that one, because even moderate Democrats today are embracing some of these more radical, you know, COVID measures and ideas about gender and ideas about spending. So time will tell, but I'm sensing a shift in the other direction.
Really interesting take, Tristan. And I guess as I was listening to you make that argument, I'm thinking basically that these elections are going to be a much more, the general elections here are going to be a much more interesting test of all of that, in my opinion. Now, after Glenn Youngkin won in a blue state, it was a shockwave for establishment Democrats. They felt like they sort of had this brief moment of reckoning early hours of the morning on CNN saying, oh, maybe we'd sort of gone too far with this and that. And then it just sort of shifted. And the mainstream argument became that it was racism and whatever else that, you know, white rage or anxiety or anything that had boosted Youngkin, disinformation, whatever it was, had boosted Youngkin in Virginia. Some establishment Democrats, Third Way, for instance, commissioned polling to nudge the party into a better direction and away from some extremism, at least on the surface. They absolutely went bananas for a Michigan representative who defended herself against an allegation that she was a groomer, or I forget exactly the precise language, whether she was a groomer or whether she was supporting or enabling groomers. But she just delivered, I think, if that's their winning ticket, is that message, which is embracing all of it by being emotional and offended, which is what a lot of people in the media, centrist type people, suddenly said. I think her name is Mallory McMorrow, was a way to win. I think they're completely deluded. But if you look at John Fetterman, this is almost reminiscent of like a Randy Bryce. If you look at Tim Ryan is less so because he's a longtime politician, but Fetterman doesn't go anywhere without wearing Carhartt. I'm going to read from his campaign website. This is who just absolutely trounced Connor Lamb. Connor Lamb was the toast of the town when he won in the Trump era, his house district in the Trump era. Moderate Dems absolutely love him. The party establishment absolutely loves him. They think that he sort of carries the torch for centrist Democrats in a very convincing, persuasive way. He got trounced by Fetterman last night. And Fetterman's website, he describes himself as a different kind of Democrat. John doesn't look like a typical politician, and more importantly, he doesn't act like one. He supported legalizing marijuana before it was popular, officiated a same-sex marriage before it was legal, and pushed for single-payer healthcare long before it was mainstream. The issues John is running on now are the same issues he's been working on for the last 2 decades. He's a Bernie guy, looks like, you know, just an average Pennsylvania dude. Like I said, he's always wearing Carhartt. He is just, you know, he seems to, on the outside at least, like, you know, he wouldn't have the pretensions and blind spots of a sort of longtime DC politician. And yet he's doing something that Randy Bryce tried to do in Wisconsin, that Jason Kander tried to do in Missouri, which is say, if you can be sort of boldly progressive for Medicare for all, for a lot of the cultural priorities, as long as you're honest about it, and as long as you seem authentic, and as long as you don't talk down to voters, and et cetera, et cetera. I think that Tim Ryan versus J.D. Vance is going to be a fascinating matchup. And I think Fetterman versus either Oz or McCormick is going to be a fascinating matchup that really tests a lot of this stuff in a helpful way in swing states as important as Ohio and Pennsylvania, Tristan.
Yeah, well, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but Lamb won in 2018. Did he win in 2018?
Yeah, I think it was 2018.
Okay, yeah. I mean, again, the first midterms of any new president is always going to be so hostile to the president's party in power. I think that race could have gone another way had Hillary won in 2016. But I think you're right about Tim Ryan. I don't think Tim Ryan's going to be a blow over race. I mean, he's no joke of a candidate. I don't think it's going to be that close, considering where the nation is in this year, and particularly in Ohio, where Donald Trump comfortably carried the state by about 8 points both times. And Ohio is also a state that doesn't tend to like both of its senators from the same party. It's kind of like Montana. They tend to they tend to have a Democratic senator and a Republican senator, and it's been that way for years. But Sherrod Brown is a perfect example of the type of super liberal progressive person who can continually win elections again and again and again. But he's also got this blue collar appeal, this honesty about his policies, this likability to him. Sherrod Brown's, I mean, I know people who have worked for him. He's just a genuinely a nice person, comes from a nice family, and yet he is as far left as Elizabeth Warren. And so I don't think Ohio will go for Tim Ryan, but he's definitely not a joke of a candidate. And I think J.D. Vance is most likely going to win in November. But you're right. If Democrats can still have this blue collar appeal, they can still be super progressive on a lot of issues. I think a lot of politics today has become so much less about the policy and so much more about, I hate to say popularity contest, but it's a lot more about the personality now. It's a lot more, I think, cultural issues have also taken center stage in a lot of ways. So, you know, we'll see how it shakes out. But Tim Ryan's no joke.
Yeah, I agree with that totally. And Tim Ryan and Sherrod Brown are people who could be very different Democrats in a very different climate. I don't know. And it's Bernie Sanders is the exact same. I don't know what would have happened with Bernie Sanders, Sherrod Brown and Tim Ryan. If the party, this is impossible. It's an impossible hypothetical. But if the party hadn't shifted quickly so left on a lot of the cultural issues, and that's where I think Ohio, where you have Vance versus Ryan, is going to be absolutely fascinating. And I remember when Randy Bryce was running against Paul Ryan, I saw Bryce, and I'm from Wisconsin, not super far from this district. I saw Bryce at Netroots Nation, and I asked him to define intersectionality for me. And it was really, I know that that sounds like tongue in cheek and funny, but I'm thinking about, you know, the people of the district and thinking about this guy who wants to represent them. And here he is at Netroots talking this really big progressive game. And that's what Fetterman and Tim Ryan are going to have to do. They still have to speak to their base, but they also have to speak to their voters. And that's, I think, going to be really tough when you have a Republican Party that's gotten, frankly, a lot smarter on cultural issues, especially when you look at somebody like J.D. Vance. That's where I think Oz is a very odd matchup with somebody like Fetterman, even McCormick to some extent. But, you know, Oz has issues with China. I could see Fetterman absolutely trouncing him on that. And Fetterman, by the way, is the lieutenant governor, current lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania, former mayor. He does have a master's from Harvard. I could see him just in a state like Pennsylvania trouncing Oz over his ties with China, trouncing McCormick over his business career. And it's going to see how competing versions of populism in a Republican Party that's gotten much smarter about China and has gotten much smarter about speaking to working class voters, these competing versions of populism from the left and the right between J.D. Vance and Tim Ryan. And Tim Ryan, as you say, Tristan, does at least try to put on a populist front from the left. That these races are going to be really, really interesting from that perspective.
Right. And the defining thing about these candidates who are each embracing this kind of blue collar character, you have to be able to stand up to the voters and convince the people that you care about their needs. And I think people can pick up on that on either ends of populism. You just need to be able to convince the voters that you are serving them and going to Washington and their own interests. And I think people can kind of smell if you're not genuine. You know, Richard Cordray, I think, was a good example this in Ohio. He's a guy who ran for statewide in Ohio, and I don't think he was. I mean, this is a guy who ran I think it was the FDIC in Washington D.C. It was Elizabeth Warren's big project on consumer protection. So he had come from this glitzy Washington bureaucratic background. He comes back to Ohio to run for statewide office, and I don't think he could convince the voters here that he was truly in their interests, or if he was just looking for another political stepping stone. And I think that's very important in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania.
Tristan, it's actually difficult, I think, to get good primary analysis from the legacy media because it's, again, there's this impulse to fit everything into a big national box to make it about Trump. And I think that's how you make local races compelling to a national audience. So I have sympathy out there for the producers who the producers and editors who have to make this content compelling to national audiences. But I do think those analyses, and you're right to go back to Connor Lamb. We were said that centrist Democrats had won the tug of war. And I think that was something similar sort of with the Schrader race with a lot of pouring into it, similar with Chantel Brown, as you mentioned. But in reality, it's about who's a better candidate and who's a better candidate in the context of that community. And you can say the same Senate races, governor races, you know, who's the better candidate in that state, who's able to attract more money and pitch their message in an effective way. So I just think it's, as we go through this midterm cycle, it's really not the same as a presidential race. And I appreciate, Tristan, all of your work on this. And I know that we will be continuing to follow in these races through that lens. And I hope having a more nuanced approach to what's happening in various places.
No, I agree. Thank you for having me on.
You're from Ohio. What did you think of the Ohio coverage?
Well, I mean, like you said, it always goes to try to nationalize all of these races. Ohio broke its tradition last cycle. It had every election since 1960, Ohio had voted for the president who ended up winning the White House. No one had ever won in the Electoral College without winning Ohio. Trump was the first person to break that since 1960. He won Ohio pretty handily, but lost in the Electoral College, albeit by 44,000 votes across three tipping point states, an election that had record turnout in the form of mail-in voting. But the Ohio coverage, it's a lot easier for national reporters, especially if they're not that familiar with the state, to nationalize the coverage. And that's why we're seeing a lot of nationalization of our politics in general. People, these candidates want to tie themselves to national figures, national pundits, and national politicians. Again, it goes back to these candidates embracing Trumpism, even if Trump doesn't embrace them. So this movement that Trump really kicked into gear in 2016, that's what's dominating the party today. And it is bleeding blood red in Ohio.
To that extent, it is. There is something, I think, nationally going on in terms of what you look at, what candidates are pushing and who's endorsing them. So, yeah, I think that's a good point. Tristan Justice, Western correspondent at The Federalist. He's going to continue Western corresponding and sometimes Eastern corresponding. We send him wherever we want him to go. Tristan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray. Today.